Thank you for joining us. My name is Katie Heinle, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make it fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can support the podcast on Patreon with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod's shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. Today, I'm interviewing Matea Jokic. Matea is a second-year PhD student at the University of California, Irvine in Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. She received her master's in Fish and Wildlife Management from Montana State University and her bachelor's in psychology from the University of California, San Diego. When she's not handling fish, you can feed her at home knitting or crocheting. Welcome to the podcast, Matea.
Thanks for having me, Katie. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited you're here. Okay, I always like to start with people's background. So can you tell me where you first developed your interest in fisheries and conservation?
Okay, yeah. So I was a little late to the game. I was not one of the people who knew that they wanted to be a fish biologist since they were little. I actually didn't know that people were biologists or fish biologists. In my mind, it was kind of just the thing that you saw on TV, and people on TV were those people, but it would never be me. But I've always been interested in conservation and the outdoors. And then when I was in college, I got to go to the International Hypoxia Symposium in Canada. That was my first conference where I was able to present a poster, and they had an entire section on comparative physiology, and they were looking at fish and bird models. And I was like, oh my God, there are people who actually, you know, work on animals. They do this really cool research. So I came back really excited, and I was talking to my advisors at UCSD, and they were all really excited. And they were like, yeah, do animal research. Like, that sounds so fun. You'd be great at it. So they really encouraged me to look towards fish and birds, more fish, because there was somebody in my lab biased towards fish. So it kind of was a late blooming type thing, because that was my senior year in undergrad that I kind of realized that.
Yeah, because you got your bachelor's in psychology, but at that same time you're doing physiology type research, right?
Yeah, I got my bachelor's in psychology, and so part of the program at UCSD, you needed to have I don't remember if it was a quarter or a year of research under your belt. And I wanted to figure out what lab I would do that in. And I kept reaching out and I kept not hearing back. And then one of my friends was like, oh, there's this cool research, like in the med school with people at high altitude and you like mountains. And that sounds like something up your alley. And I was like, you know, whatever, I will just, you know, it's not what was in my field, but I reached out and they were so responsive. Like, they were really excited and they were like, oh yeah, we need an undergrad. So come in and, you know, you can see the lab. And then I was confused because it was like, they were so welcoming that I was like, wait, is this it? Like, I'm in the lab already. And so they let me do human physiology research. And then they also let me run like my own kind of side project where I was using my psych training. So we did kind of concurrent studies.
That's awesome. So did you know you were interested in research earlier on in undergrad, or did that develop later too?
Early on, I was an engineering major and had no intention of going to grad school. And then I switched my major like 3 times, landing on psychology at the beginning of my junior year, I think, or end of my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that I thought I had to go to grad school if I was getting a psych bachelor's, because I didn't know what you could do with a bachelor's in psych. So I figured I could get a master's or a PhD in psychology and then practice or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I needed to do research to get into grad school. So that was my junior year that I kind of had that thought click in my head.
Cool. And then you found physiology and you totally switched course.
Yes. I was like telling my parents, I think I should major in biology. Like, I want to switch my major. And they were like, you are in your 4th year. You can't switch your major. So I was like, okay. So finished in psychology and then found my way to bio and physiology in grad school.
Yeah. So you graduated and then I know you went to South Dakota to work. Was that your first job after undergrad? And can you tell me about that if it was?
Yeah, that was my first job after undergrad. I had applied to like 30 something different jobs that had fish and wildlife associations. And I heard back from 2 places. One of them was South Dakota, and then the other one was a volunteer unpaid position in Washington. And then that fell through. And then South Dakota called me and told me that they had filled all the positions. So I technically did not get it in the first round, but then the person they offered the position to didn't want it. So they called me back and asked me if I wanted it. And it was my only option. So yeah. I said yes, but it was also like the best experience. Like it was like the most formative experience of my life. Like I'm so happy that that's the way things played out, because I genuinely think that if I didn't go to that internship, I probably would have no idea what I'm doing still.
Yeah. Can you tell us what you did for the internship?
Oh yes. Sorry. I got lost in the story of how I got there. So I kind of got to do a little bit of everything. I started out with doing krill surveys and speaking to anglers, who are out on Lake Oahe and the Missouri River in South Dakota. And then after doing that for a few months, we started doing some surveys. So we did deep water gill netting, and we did different types like seining and all those kind of like collective surveys that they do to look at populations in the Missouri River in South Dakota. And then I asked to stay on longer because I really enjoyed it, and they let me stay on longer. So then I got to do a bunch of electrofishing, and I helped out with salmon spawning because there are Chinook salmon in the river in South Dakota, but they are spawned. They're not naturally occurring there. So I helped spawn them, and I did otolith aging. I really did a little bit of everything while I was there.
That's so cool. Then you went to your master's. So can you tell us about the process of like applying for that and what project you did?
Yeah, it was really kind of a fun experience looking for my master's, because I had walked into the office one day in South Dakota and asked one of the biologists there that if he thought I could get a master's, and he kind of was surprised, I think, because like everything was based on those 6 months that I was there, but he was like, yeah, I don't like, why not? And then so after that, I was speaking with all the biologists, and they were like, well, this is where we went, you know, you can see if they have openings. And so I looked around at every state touching South Dakota, because I really liked South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to Christine Verhill, who was my master's advisor, and she was receptive and offered me to come out and see the campus and meet her. And then from there, it just kind of took its course. And that is how I got into my master's program.
That's awesome. And that is where we met, because I'm still in the Verhill lab, which was really excited. I still got to overlap a little bit with you.
Yeah. Despite COVID having happened.
Can you tell us about what you researched for that project?
Yeah. So I was happy that Christine is also into physiology. So that was part of my project. I worked on juvenile pallid sturgeon in the upper basin of the Missouri River. And specifically, we were looking at trying to create a non-lethal field health assessment to assess the status of those fish. And my two chapters that I focused on were like using a device called the fat meter to estimate energetic reserves in juvenile pallid sturgeon, so lipid and energy content of the fish. Mm-hmm. And then I also looked at blood biochemistry. So it's like when you go to the doctor and they run up like a blood panel on you to see if you're iron deficient or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We were just trying to see what values were considered normal for the juveniles so that we could come out the range, and then biologists would be able to track whether or not individuals they pulled out of the river fell within those ranges if they took their blood.
Yeah. That's such a cool project. Can you tell us what you found for that?
Yeah. So for the fat meter work, which we're writing up the manuscript right now, we found that the fat meter by itself was not as promising in juveniles as it has been shown in other species of fish. And we think the limitations come from a size component mainly, that their scutes on pallid sturgeon and the fat meter sensor might be interrupted by the position of the scutes. Mm-hmm. And then there are also some like fat deposit differences in sturgeon than other species that we've considered maybe an issue too. But we did see an improvement as my fish got larger. So we thought that it would be promising to look at adult pallid sturgeon, the performance of the fat meter in adult pallid sturgeon. And that is currently what Christine is working on with another student in our lab, in my old lab and your lab. So that's exciting that that's still going.
Yeah, definitely. And then was the blood biochemistry, were those metrics more helpful or?
Yeah. So we were basically setting the baseline for those metrics. So I didn't continue to do like a comparison study.
Very cool. And then, so you defended and left our lab. And then you went to start your PhD at UC Irvine. So can you tell us what you're researching now for that project?
Yeah. So it's kind of changed a bit since I started. I learned some things that I didn't know about the fish that are local to the area. For context, Irvine is on the coast, or is pretty close to the coast. So mm-hmm. we have like coastal ecosystems here, which I've not worked in before. So currently I'm looking at three species of silver-sized fish. So I'm looking at California grunion, top smelt, and jack smelt. And then I'm trying to look at the gut microbial diversity in each of those species. And then we're going to do a comparison between each of the species. And then top smelt are also endemic to Catalina Island. So it's a different habitat. And we're interested in potentially looking at the gut microbial diversity in those fish at Catalina versus their counterparts here in Newport Bay, which mm-hmm. is a bay close to Irvine, and seeing what the differences are there, because they do have different diets as well.
Cool. So what does gut microbiology, was that the right one?
it's the gut microbiome.
Okay. What does the gut microbiome tell us about the health of these fish? Or like, is that like a management type question?
Yeah. So that's what I want to do, I guess, for later chapters of my dissertation. There is evidence in some species of fish that have been exposed to different types of pollutants, like crude oil, that their gut microbiome changes either in response to the crude oil or like to try to moderate the effects of the crude oil. Mm-hmm. And the gut microbiome, you've probably been hearing about that in like human stuff too. Like you want to take care of your gut bacteria because it's really important for your health and in your digestive efficiency. And it's the same thing for fish. So I'm interested in looking at this. This will end up probably being separate from what I'm doing now, but like having a manipulative study with fish who naturally live in waters that are more or less polluted based on, you know, if it's polluted by wastewater or if it's polluted by stormwater runoff or something like that. I'd like to look at those fish and see how their gut microbial diversity differs. Mm-hmm. And then also have a laboratory component where we might be changing the pollution levels in the lab.
Yeah, that's super cool. So is it mainly looking at the diversity of species, or is it which species are there?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
Yeah, because in some of the literature there that I've read, it's that some species are present because of the exposure to certain pollutants. Mm-hmm. So they could be used as indicators of pollutants in waterways.
Okay.
But I'm like, this is the other component that I forgot to mention that's in my mind as it's brewing. I really want to look at aerobic performance. So like aerobic scope. So looking at standard metabolic rate and maximum metabolic rate of the fish exposed to these different pollution treatments, mm-hmm. and see if there is like a bacteria in the gut that might be moderating the effects of the pollutants on their fitness.
Okay. I was also curious, how do you sample gut microbiomes? Is that gastric lavage, or do you take the stomachs?
Yeah. So we're taking out, I guess technically in silver sides, they don't have stomachs per se. They've got intestines, like everything is just intestines. So we take out their intestines, and then okay. I'm subsampling the intestines into different parts. So proximal, middle, and then distal intestines.
Okay.
And then from there we remove the contents. So we will be looking at the contents independently of the actual tissues, because potentially they'll have different microbial diversity.
Yeah.
And then I'm also looking at, I'm terrible at explaining my project. There's another like aspect to it. I'm also looking at mucosal swabs and cloacal swabs and fecal samples to try to see if any of those non-lethal metrics will mm-hmm. estimate what's in the gut.
Oh yeah.
And then see if managers can use that instead of having to kill the fish like we have to.
Yeah. Very cool. How do you go out and sample these? Is like a hook and line, or do you use seine nets? Or
yeah, it's fun because each of them has a different method. So grunion, I don't know if you've heard of the grunion run before, but they come up on the sand to spawn from like, I think it's March to occasionally September, but maybe just August is usually the last month. So it varies by year, but mm-hmm. they have these estimates of when the fish are going to come out and spawn. So then it'll be like between midnight and 2 a.m. So then we're out there like to collect my fish. I went last month with my friend in the program and Dylan. And then we were out there like looking for the fish, and people kept being like, did you see any? We're like, no, you know, like everybody was also looking for the fish at midnight on the, mm-hmm. in the ocean. And then finally some of them started running up, and then you like see the female kind of burrows their rear into the sand to deposit the eggs. And then the male curls around to then fertilize the eggs. So then you'll see that happening, and then you run and you grab them with your hands. Yeah. So you could grab as many as you want, as long as you use your hands and stick them in a bucket. And then, so I caught two, and then Dylan went out and he caught like 10. And yeah. So he got the rest for me. And then we worked them up. They were alive. We kept them alive until we euthanized them.
Yeah.
For the dissections.
Yeah. Very cool.
And so that's grunion. And then, we seine for the top smelt. So top smelt are in Newport Bay, and Back Bay Science Center goes out and conducts surveys to look at, I think, population density. And it's in response to a dredging treatment that they had a few years ago. So they're trying to see like what's happening to the population based on this dredging that they did. Mm-hmm. So they are already going out and sampling them, and they catch a bunch of them. So I just take a subsample of the fish yeah. that they catch and then use them there. And then jack smelt is hook and line off the pier. And awesome. I'm really bad at fishing here. So I have not caught a single jack smelt, but people are kind enough to be like, oh, you want this? Here you go. And then they give nice. It to me.
Yeah. There you go. That's really fun. I bet you'll get better as you do it more.
Yes. A man gave me his entire like rig for catching top smelt and nice. Said, yep, just go put shrimp on it and try it next time you come out. So
that's so nice.
Or sorry, jack smelt.
Yeah. Very cool. Are these species anadromous, or are they mainly marine species?
Yeah, they're marine species.
That's really cool. Definitely a big change from your other work. That's awesome.
Yeah. I really wanted to make a point. If I was in California, I wanted to work with at least some coastal species.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great opportunity. Okay. I was looking through your CV, and I noticed you have done a lot of mentoring over the last few years. And I was just curious what you like about being a mentor.
I think that the only reason why I have figured out where I want to be today is because of help from mentors that I've had along the way. And I really want to be able to reciprocate that and give that to students, or it doesn't even have to be students, anyone yeah. who could possibly benefit from anything that I've experienced. I would yeah. like to help them with that and give them my, what is the word? Oh gosh, I was literally just talking about this today with one of the women who worked at Back Bay. But basically I wanted to put my belief into someone, because I think when you give mm-hmm. them your belief, and then you think you acknowledge their potential, then they grow and they succeed.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you have any tips for other people that are hoping to be good mentors to people around them?
I think that recognizing that people often focus on the most negative aspects of their CV or things about them that they perceive is good in being able to point out that that's not the only thing about them. Like I mm-hmm. focused a lot on my low undergrad GPA when I was applying for grad schools or really doing anything. I focused on them like, oh gosh, that's always going to bring me down. Mm-hmm. But every mentor I've had is like, it doesn't mean anything, you know, like it's not a summary of you as a person or you as a, you know, a researcher. So here are the things that, you know, you do well, and acknowledging what that your mentee does well.
Yeah.
And then being able to give that positive feedback. And if they want constructive criticism, being able to be very constructive with it and put like very positive spin, something yeah. that they can actually use for their future.
Yeah, that's great. You also, when I was talking with you about what we wanted to cover in this podcast, mentioned that you started a blog. Can you tell me about some of the topics you cover with that and what you like about blogging?
Yeah. So I got into the idea of blogging during COVID because I started reading blogs. Like I read them when I was younger, and then it kind of, you know, went to college and was too busy. But because I had extra time on my hands, I started watching people on YouTube, and then I started reading blogs more. And there's so much to learn from people and their experiences. And you don't meet most people in the world as you progress through life, because, you know, you meet the people around you. So I wanted to be able to put my experiences out on a platform so that some people who may have had like a similar undergraduate GPA or like background in a completely different field could feel that they could succeed regardless of that. So my, what I did poorly or what I feel brought me down or whatever, wasn't actually anything I did poorly or brought me down. And I want other people to know that they can still, you know, continue on beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we link to that in our show notes?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
I'll send you the link for that. I also talk about backpacking and traveling in there too, but that's like, that's the fun part of the blog for me. Just like, oh, look at all my pictures.
That's awesome. Cool. Yeah. I'm excited to link to that and read through it myself. Okay. And this is a question I like to ask everybody because I am really bad at just focusing on my work and science and all that. So I was wondering what hobbies and interests you have outside of science and conservation?
Like I said before, I'm into backpacking and I like hiking. I like doing anything that's outside, which kind of falls into the science and conservation aspect. But if we pretend it doesn't, those are probably the larger hobbies that we have that take more time and effort to plan. Mm-hmm. And then I knit and crochet, and I do. So like I made a bear for my friend's baby recently, and now I'm trying to knit myself a shirt because I can now knit a t-shirt because I live somewhere where I can wear t-shirts again and not just sweaters. But yeah, aside from that, the blog is now a new interest. And I've gardened. I started gardening because it's easier to garden here than it is in Bozeman. And that's been really fun. Like we actually had pretty good harvest this year, considering what my garden was like in Bozeman.
That's awesome. Yeah. I remember seeing some photos of your garden on Instagram and I was so jealous. I've got this one tomato plant. There's so many tomatoes and they just refuse to ripen.
You can keep the tomato even when it's to bring it inside after it freezes and they'll ripen if you leave them on the vine.
Okay, cool.
so don't let those die.
Anyways.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. It just got frosty this morning, so I'll have to start bringing them in at night.
Yeah, it's like in the 60s here at night.
Different places.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like now I'm cold when it's below 75. I'm like, oh, kind of chilly. And it's funny. I'm like laughing about it because you know, if it's 50 in Bozeman, I'm like wearing a t-shirt.
I know. Well, it was so hot this summer that I feel like my cold tolerance just got shot because it was like, I got to where it was in the 90s and I was like, this doesn't feel terrible because it's not in the hundreds. So I'm not prepared for the winter at all.
You had a SoCal summer this year.
Yeah. I didn't like it. Yeah. Well, Matea, the so-called tough part of the interview is over and we are down to the final few questions that we ask every guest that comes on the show. The first one is one of my favorites. What is your favorite fish?
I feel like that's a tough question.
I agree.
I really like hardy fish is what I've come to realize. So anything like channel catfish were like the hardiest fish I feel like I've worked with because you would have them stuck in gill nets for hours and you'd be pulling on them and having to cut their spines off and they would be fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'd be out in the air for a while and you put them back in the water and they would just swim away. So I like really hardy fish like that. But pallid sturgeon are like the cutest fish ever, in my opinion. So now I'm torn. It used to be channel cats. And then now that I've worked with pallid sturgeon and they've buried themselves in my heart, I think that they're also, maybe they're tied.
So okay.
That like they're an ancient fish in my mind. So maybe they're my favorite ancient fish.
There you go.
And then channel cats are my favorite newer fish.
That's awesome. I agree. I really love hardy fish. That's why I always like suckers are amazing.
Yes. And I like suckers because they don't hurt you. Nothing about them is going to injure you.
Exactly. Okay. Our second question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I feel like every time I think about those, they all have to do with getting stuck in mud. Like there have been several situations on the Missouri River where I've been like trapped in mud and been worried that I like, when I think of animals that get fossilized, I'm like, is this what it was for them? Is this how it happened? But like once the boat captain dropped me off where it seemed to be somewhere walkable, and I sunk to like my knees or above, and I had to crawl on the mud to not sink in more. And then they went to go pick me up because it obviously was not a fruitful effort to walk in this area. And I could not even lift myself up because I was so heavy with the mud that had filled my boots and, you know, pulled me down that they had to pull me onto the boat. And it was so funny. Like everyone was just laughing because it was such a difficult thing to pull this muddy person out of the mud and put them on the boat. And then everything was just covered in mud. And it was so funny. So that's, it's like every mud experience has been that kind of same thing where it's just hilarious.
Yeah. That's awesome. What is your dream job and or location?
I guess I don't know where I'd want to work. I have not figured that part out yet. I would like to travel a lot during my PhD to figure out where the next place is. But in terms of a dream job, I really want to have my work applied to conservation. So I think that being in a joint position with like a federal agency and then also a university would be really nice medium, because I could get to do the research, but then I would also get to be on the side of things where policy is happening and implementation is happening and all of that.
Yeah, definitely. All right. If money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
That's funny. I feel like I've never thought of anything in terms of research without considering the money.
Yeah.
But probably, and this is like general because I haven't thought about this too much, but something where I could go somewhere that has a polluted waterway or a polluted aquatic ecosystem, and then I would be able to work on indicator species in that ecosystem to reflect how beneficial certain types of treatments were. And this would be in conjunction with management agencies or conservation efforts that were already going on. But I would imagine this would be in a different country is kind of what I think. Somewhere that maybe doesn't have the infrastructure that we have, where this could be really important and help a lot. So it's really vague, but something like that.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Our final question is, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Take what you need and leave what you don't, and use everything that you take. I feel like we live in a consumerist society. I mean, we do live in a consumerist society, and I consume a lot of things, but I think having my garden has made me think more about food in ways that I don't usually think about. Like, yeah, you could go to the grocery store and grab a 6 bell peppers and then go home and not have two thoughts about it. But seeing how slowly my fruits and vegetables grow, I appreciate more the effort that goes into growing crops and things in our country. And I want to be more mindful about when I purchase my groceries or even the meat that I'm eating. I want to know more where things are coming from and make sure that I'm not letting anything go to waste after I bring it home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice.
Yeah, I think it expands to conservation too.
Absolutely. Very cool. All right. Well, thanks so much, Matea, for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all of your work. I'm really excited to see how your PhD work turns out. People want to get find out more information or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
If they would like to find out more information, I guess they could follow my new blog.
Yeah.
And if they want to get a hold of me, my email at UCI is djokicm@uci.edu. And I check that every day, multiple times a day. So Katie will have that in the description too.
Yep. I'll include that in the show notes. If you'd like to get a hold of me or the podcast, you can find me at KB Hindley on Twitter. And the podcast is on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or you can send us an email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you all enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Katie Hindley. Thank you for listening to the 144th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, take only what you need, leave what you don't, and use everything you take.